Talking about my ordinance here?
Your next thing on the agenda.
Okay, this is the discussion of the pending ordinance for what I call is just the density ordinance calculation. And this ordinance has generated a lot of public input in the forms of public speaking, emails, letters, editorials, and overall general comments. This will be a big change. Having the public input has been really good. However, this ordinance is not new to Sussex County. It's been mentioned in the last two comprehensive land use plans, and it is currently mentioned in the latest draft of the comprehensive land use plan. So this thing's been on the horizon, you know, for a little while. So it's clear to me that action is needed, and I believe that action is needed now. What has become equally clear to me with the introduction of this ordinance is the confusion as to the definitions as to what's calculated in the density, and more importantly, what's not calculated in the density calculation. So today, I wish to just clear this confusion up, because wetlands is just a hard topic to understand, and this affects a lot of people. And I just want to be clear what this ordinance is and what it isn't. So I've asked staff to look at the ordinance language and to give us a better understanding of how this ordinance is written and what lands are impacted and what lands aren't. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Moore and Mr. Robertson just for an educational seminar of the ordinance that's written. And then if council has any questions or concerns, we can ask them of the experts. And then we can have a discussion and see where it goes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burton. Taking a step back on it, what we did when this ordinance was drafted was incorporate existing language that was in our code, which was in section 115.193. That's all the definitions of the tidal wetlands of streams and that sort of thing. We thought at the time that because that had been in our code for 30 years without any real confusion or incident, that it would be good to just rely on that and keep things uncomplicated. Famous last words, perhaps, as we heard in the public hearings. Because as you know, during the public hearing process, we did hear criticisms and concerns from a majority of the people that spoke about those various definitions, that they were confusing. What do they mean? They rely on state statutes that are less than clear, that have been in effect for quite some time. Really, there was a loud and clear call to try to address the definitions that are in our code, which then this ordinance relies on. And so it's all tied together. And I should point out that this is all incorporated in the short title of this ordinance, these proposed fixes. So as Mr. Medlars, or excuse me, as Mr. Burton mentioned, staff, including Mr. Medlars, what we've done is worked on the definitions to try to improve and update them. And I think Mr. Lawson or somebody's operating the screen. What we've done sort of is generally gotten rid of the reference to state code and the DENREC maps. We took some of that confusion language and updated it. And I know Mr. Medlars, particularly with his engineering background, was a big help in trying to come up with language that was clear. So again, the definitions, which are the basis of what's counted or not counted towards density, one of the things that we looked at was the first definition with regard to what the buffer zone is. That just clarifies that it's an undisturbed area along the wetlands. So that doesn't really change much beyond what we currently have in code. So if we could go to the next one. This one, the mean high water line of tidal water, say the average height of all the high tide water recorded over a 19-year period is defined by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration tidal datum. What we did is just change that, through input, the mean high water line of any tidal water body, tidal stream, or tidal marsh, just to clear that up. So if we go to the next one.
You said input from who, though? You said input.
Staff, and largely okay. Mr. Medlars, with his background on this type of thing. Okay. So, non-tidal wetlands, we've actually deleted what was in the code and come up with this definition: lands above the water elevation of the mean high tide water line regulated under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act of 1972. That's one of the definitional fixes, but when we get to a proposed change to the ordinance, that's going to be excluded from the ordinance, and I'll get to that in a second. So, let's go to the next one. The current definition of perennial non-tidal rivers and streams is any body of water which continuously flows during a year and which is not subject to tidal influence. That's not a real clear definition that can be, I would say, uniformly applied. The amended proposed one is any body of water which continuously flows during a year and which is not subject to tidal influence and depicted on the most recent version of the National Hydrography. What he said, data set. That way, we've got a map that everybody can go to and figure out, all right, this is either applies or it doesn't. Yeah, so if we go to the next one. Tidal wetlands, and this is one of the ones that referred to that state code, which a lot of people had concerns about, looking at when that state code was adopted. It previously referred to areas under the jurisdiction of Title VII, Chapter 66 of the Delaware Code, as the chapter appears as of the date of adoption, which was many years ago, of this article, as regulated map by the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. We've simplified that significantly. Lands below the water elevation of the mean high tide water line regulated under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act of 1972. So that gives us a line that we know we can work with. So let me go to the next one. And then this one is just wetlands. It's just going to be deleted. Recall that it's going to be replaced by the definition of non-tidal wetlands. So we're getting rid of that one. Again, that referred to that Title VII, Chapter 66 of the Delaware Code reference. So what that will do with those amendments will make it clear to everybody what exactly we're talking about, because, again, there was confusion and concern over those old definitions in our code. The other proposal that we want to do to make clear is that within that ordinance that was introduced, in each spot there was reference to non-tidal wetlands being excluded from density calculations. That's the 404 wetlands, the pocket wetlands that a lot of people talked about, which was, again, controversial. So we're going to take out that phrase non-tidal wetlands so that's 100% clear. And then the other thing that we heard was that from the agricultural community, they wanted to be certain that, if they put in an ag ditch or, in their farm to help with drainage, a man-made ditch, that sort of thing, or farm pond, they don't want to be penalized, coming back in with density. So we would add a phrase to each one of these sections that says, this exclusion, again, from the density calculations, this exclusion shall not include farm ponds, tax ditches, or other man-made bodies of water where these waters are not located on or within perennial streams. That language actually does come from our code, but that makes it clear that if you put in an ag ditch on your farm to help with drainage, it's not a stream, it can be counted towards density, because that was a large concern of the farming community.
It can be, it doesn't have to be, but it can be, is what we're saying, right?
Yeah.
There's still that option.
Yes. So what we propose, that unless there's questions today, but would be, first of all, planning and zoning hasn't acted on this. It's on their agenda for Thursday night. Hopefully have a recommendation from P&Z coming out of Thursday night, then come back to council on the, not next Tuesday, but the following Tuesday, with proposed motions for amendments to this ordinance for your consideration, and then you would act one way or another on the ordinance on that Tuesday.
So, Mr. Robertson, the the amendments, proposed amendments you just went through make it very clear what Mr. Burton's initial intent was, that he was having it for the state wetlands only and not what is known as the 404 or the pocket wetlands.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, because most of the opposition that we heard was never the intent of the ordinance. And so that led me to believe there was confusion. So I think this ought to clear it up for us. We ought to take time and take these 2 weeks to you get it to us, right?
Yes, yeah, in accordance also with P&Z's recommendation.
Right. So we wait for P&Z, we get what is already written just easier to understand, and then I would look for a vote on the 27th.
Okay.
Being he introduced you to as the two experts, my question is, I heard public comments at our hearings. The farming community concerned about the density, buffer density, removing that in one way or another would affect the value of their land. Can you give an answer on that? You're the expert here.
Well,
you know an expert is, don't you? That's somebody more than 50
miles. Now, we're talking about, because the buffer issue is another issue. We're talking about this one, which is the wetlands densities.
I'm talking about, how does it reach here? Permitted density.
Yeah, permitted density. I'm not an appraiser. Let me start that out. It's in terms of the use of the ongoing use of the farm. You know, they're still going to be able to farm it. It's not going to affect that. And I can't say that with any certainty, because it's going to depend where the property is located, whether there's wetlands on the property, the extent of the wetlands. Then there's other factors that come into play, including our existing wetlands. You know, just so it, you know, that's an answer, unfortunately, that I can't give you specifics on, because it's going to depend on so many different criteria that are related to that property.
Yeah. And there was a lot of concern in the testimony that there was a question about farm ditches, drainage ditches that were on the properties, that there was a feeling that it was unclear whether or not that they were being included in the density or not. And if that was being included, that would make a big difference on the appraised values of the properties. This is making sure that there's no confusion about those areas. Now, obviously, if someone is next to a major stream or a river, there is a difference there, because that's flowing water. But as far as a lot of the farmers' concerns and ag concerns about ditches, isolated wetlands on the property, this is trying to make sure that it's very clear that these items are not included in that and not affected by this.
Well, what here's my concern. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about the permitted densities now, currently you can use the wetlands, whatever they are, wetlands, as a density calculation for a number of lots on a piece of property.
Right.
Okay. I heard people who own property, I will say this, I own no farmland, I own nothing except the house I live in, so it's not going to bother me. But I am concerned if I'm going to vote on something to devalue somebody's property. That concerns me.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to have somebody who can give us an answer, well, whether it's an appraisal company or whoever it is.
Well, Mike, let me just go ahead.
No, in mind that the large concern about that was with regard to non-tidal wetlands. That's where we heard most of the testimony come in and say, you know, I have non-tidal wetlands that are on my property that, you know, I can farm or, you know, or whatever. You know, and that's where the concern about the property values, I think, came into play. And that's where the confusion lied. You know, I'm okay with it, I think, is what a lot of people said, if we're not talking about the non-tidal wetlands. You know, and so that's what we wanted to clear up. And, you know, again, it's going to depend farm by farm, I guess, but I'm not aware that it, you know, what the property values would be, but this certainly minimizes the effect, if there is any, on property values by taking out all those non-tidal wetlands, because that's again what we heard about.
No, I'll just say this, Mike. When it comes to the value of the land, it's like anything else in real estate. It's going to first of all be location, available infrastructure, how it sits on our land use plan map, levels of service with DLDOT 1, 2, 3, or 4, the amount of wetlands is part of it, right? But I'd had a conversation with Mr. Horsey, who was opposed to this 100%, and then because it said, he was confused. He said it thought it was all wetlands, freshwater and tidal wetlands. And when I said no, the intent is for tidal wetlands, he says, if you, and he didn't say this was off the record, I think, so if I'm wrong, he can clearly straighten me out. But anyway, he said he's not opposed. He wasn't opposed if it was tidal wetlands. So I think that everybody's gone into the fact with tidal wetlands, you know, is a legitimate reason to do it, because you have AR1 land. You can't develop. You can't put lots. You can't put houses on the wetlands. So it's not on the table. So when these guys are buying land, you have to come in and get further approvals to get multifamily and other things to be able to gross calculate. And we're actually seeing very few, and if you can tell me, has anybody, and you may not be aware of it historically because you haven't been here that long, but I can't imagine, I can't think of any project that has come in front that calculated tidal wetlands. Can you remember anything, to anybody who's calculated tidal wetlands? First thing they do, they like to impress us, say, we're not using the tidal wetlands as a density calculation, but I can't remember anything in years that was ever used. Can anybody point out an example where developers?
There have been multiple examples of applications that have come forward because they'll use the entire land. They might protect it and not build on it, but they will use it as part of density.
The title. Well, I'm just talking about tidal wetlands.
Yes.
It's the total square footage.
You stand corrected, correct?
I stand corrected, but yeah, I'd like to see one because, I don't think
first
we...
First time in 30 years.
That's okay. No, okay. Now, my recollection is that they didn't use it for the calculations.
Yes, and there was one that came before you not too many months ago, okay. And that was a concern that was brought before by the council that concern.
Okay.
And also to clarify, I mean, George, you just made the statement that this is in reference to preserving or protecting the wetlands. Well, I would disagree with that. I mean, it's about reducing the number of homes permitted on a property. It's called a density ordinance, right? It has nothing to do with protecting of the wetlands. That's called a buffer. That's the other. Am I wrong on that? I mean,
I think you're blatantly wrong on that one.
Then explain.
In that, if you had a piece of property that prior to, if you put 200 homes on a 100-acre piece of property, you are affecting that environment by putting 200 homes as opposed to putting 170. I mean, the impact of the 30 homes impacts the environment. And it's the amount of space that you're going to take up on that piece of land. And if you get a gross calculation of the total amount of land and get to include the wetlands in it, you are then taking that number and putting it on the upland. So by increasing the density in the environmentally sensitive tidal wetlands area, you are essentially affecting the environment of the area. I mean, you can't think that 200 homes doesn't have a greater impact on the environment than something less.
And we're supposed to, IG, have be a little stricter in the environmentally sensitive developing district. We're supposed to be environmentally sensitive. So again, more units, more parking, more roads, more all this stuff isn't environmentally sensitive. It makes pretty much common sense, and I think most of the general public has grasped that. Now, you may not have at this point, but I think the importance of wetlands is fairly common knowledge, even to elementary school kids nowadays. So this county, we've done nothing to protect. And again, is density part of it? Sure it is. Density is the other big thing that's impacting this county. And I think most people, again, we just had an election, I'll guarantee you, density was a critical issue when it came to the county council races.
But I'll go back to, which I really think was enlightening, is Mr. Barrasso's, you know, what is the effect of this gonna have on Sussex County as we know it today? I don't think it's gonna have much effect, right? But every little bit helps. But when you say that there is less than 3% of the total acreage of Sussex County will fall into these definitions, right? And then you got to say, well, how much of that land is already developed? Because that's got to be subtracted out of the 3%, right? And then if you say, well, how much of that land that's affected is in ag preservation already? Because a lot of those lands are, of those farms are on the title wetlands. You got to take them out of the 3%. I think the number gets down into less than 1% will be the affected lands of this ordinance because of its definitions of the state titled wetlands. We've built them up, and so now let's try and protect what we have, and then let's move into the next ordinance, which is buffers from wetlands. This is just a density calculation, subtracting a very small percent of the wetlands out of the calculation. I think this has more of a profound effect of saying, hey, we're starting to take this serious than it is about actually what it's going to do, because we haven't developed. We've developed in most of these areas. Most of the map that Mr. Barrasso showed is pretty much developed land. So there will be isolated areas that the density calculation will hurt, will take away. My hope is that the developments will be better developments that will lead to, you know, still the home buyers, because they want to live in an area with protected environment and protected area, and you know, jamming everything in right up next to the wetlands is an environmentally sensitive issue.
Remember, Mr. Schell was here not long ago. Mr. Schell actually stated, he stood up there at the podium and said that when we restricted development on, I think it was Black Gut, yep, forced him out of an area because of it was environmentally sensitive, it was good development. He said he built the units over there, he got more money for them, he did better off, didn't have all the infrastructure going over there, saved him money, and he made more money. So it's good for business to protect the wetlands, because people will pay more money to be abutted to something that they know is protected. It just makes common sense, and I think it's high time we did something. Mike and I talked to Bobby Horsey said, if it's title wetlands, he has no problem with it. So the impact is so minuscule, and again, the developers still have the ability to make up the money, because of when it's property abutting wetlands, they get more money.
Mr. President, if I can go back to the original question you posed of Mr. Robertson and myself, I think that the concerns that the agricultural community and others brought during the public hearing were very legitimate concerning the value of their properties. And a lot of that was due to the fact that there was questions concerning the definitions as what was exactly corrected. And I remember there was one farmer that came up and he was pointing out the different ditches went across his field. And by the time that you took those out of the calculation, then if appraisals were done on the property, it would devalue the property greatly. But by changing the definitions, it's not going to take out every situation, but many of them this will no longer affect, because of the types of things, the ditches, the farm ponds, the thing that many farmers and large landowners are concerned about, these pockets of 404 or federal wetlands. It's clear with these new definitions that they are not included in that now. They're taken out. So I think that it minimizes it. I cannot give you an answer and say it takes care of everyone. That would be wrong.
Right.
Because there are streams and there's other wetlands that are state wetlands that it is going to affect. Otherwise, why do an ordinance if it affects none? So it will on those, but it is greatly diminished and made clearer that it is only the state wetlands that are being affected.
And it was never the intent of the ordinance to devalue all these farmlands by, because 70% of the, if going with that, going with not clearing up this definition would essentially do exactly what you talked about. It would just devalue the farms. And that is not the intent.
Thank you. Anything else from council?
That's all the intent. If this is such a small area, why are we working on it? Why don't we let the county council vote on it every time they have a development come up? Can't they handle it? I mean, a new council coming up, I think we had no problem with it.
What do you mean, on a case-by-case basis?
That's what I believe. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, I would respond to that in my experience working on that side of land use, that what you hear from the developers and the attorneys is they want to know what the rules are. They don't want to do things on a case-by-case basis because then it's too difficult to plan what you all are planning and zoning will want.
Wouldn't that be their problem, with the developers?
You also get.
I think it's a problem for the county if we don't have clear rules. Right. I mean, one of the things that's come out of this.
I think it's more fair for the farmers than let the developers worry about it. It shouldn't be our problem. We should be able to vote. Each council should be able to vote every time they have a meeting on for the development rights. That's case by case.
But you get into an arbitrary and capricious argument, too, if you do one and one differently. So you have to be consistent.
The farmer then wouldn't know, nobody would know how to design or plan or sell or do anything because you would never know what the standards are. So with this, as I started to say, the silver lining is, too, we're also fixing those definitions.
That's going to be really important when you say this sets a standard. What happened to the intent?
Well, I think Mr. Burton addressed the intent.
The intent of the ordinance is cleared up by this new language.
I have a lot of problems that gives me intense.
Have you read the new ordinances?
You just handed them to me this morning, right?
Uh-huh.
So I didn't have time to read them.
Are you going to?
I will. I started reading, but I didn't get done.
So well, there were questions. So then when 2 weeks, we're going to, before 2 weeks, we're going to see a document.
Yes, with proposed motions that will amend that document, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Poff, please come forward. Port Industrial Park, Foreign Trade Zone.
You got a long way to go.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the council.
Good morning.
We have been exploring having the Delaware Coastal Business Park, the Industrial Park, and the airport designated a foreign trade zone.
Are you trying to call this a national airport now?
No, we're not.
We'd like to.
Todd, tell them whose idea it was, please.
Thank you, Mr. Cole.
There you go. I want to get it there.
This was all done at the request of Councilman Mr. Cole. Joining us today is Patty Cannon. She's with the Division of Small Business, State of Delaware, and she is the point person for this process for the State of Delaware. We also have Scott Taylor, Esquire, from Miller & Company. That's the firm that the state uses to take this foreign trade zone through the process. So what I'm going to do is turn it over to Patty Cannon, let Patty Cannon explain what the state's role is, and then we'll turn it over to Scott and let Scott explain the foreign trade zone and potentially what are the advantages. We're not here today for asking for money, but we're opening the discussion. We'll come back to you in the future if we want to move forward here for some financing.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to thank you also for putting me on the agenda after Patty Grimes. Like, she brought tears to my eyes with her video, and I'm like, geez, I can't top that. So thank you for moving me further down the agenda. So the foreign trade zone, and please know, I am the grantee administrator for the state of Delaware for the Foreign Trade Zone. I am also the point person right now on the new federal opportunity zones. So if I inadvertently throw that term in, it's because I've been living, breathing that for the last 2 months, and I apologize. The Foreign Trade Zone is a program that is administered by two federal agencies, and it needs two federal agencies to oversee it because it's such a big deal. Essentially, if we get approval from U.S. Department of Commerce Foreign Trade Zone Board to identify a parcel or a building in Delaware as a foreign trade zone, and then we go and get Customs and Border Protection under Homeland Security to actually approve and activate that, and the state concurs that that's a good use at that location, essentially that little parcel or that little building is considered for the purposes of importing and exporting as being outside U.S. territory. So that makes it a real concern for the federal government to say, what do you mean this little building down in Sussex County is no longer part of the U.S. territory, right? That's a big deal for them. So they look at it really closely. So the first thing they do is ask the state to look at a proposal and say, is this a good use at that location? It's almost always yes. An example of when it would be no is if we got a request from a North Korean company to build explosives. You know, maybe they're going to build manufacture explosives, and they wanted to do it next to one of your hospitals or next to one of your elementary schools. We would say that's not a good use at that location. But other than some really profound reason why we would say no, it's almost always going to be a yes from the state's perspective. So that's your first checkbox. And then we forward it to the U.S. Department of Customs Foreign Trade Zone Board and say, do you concur with us that this is a good use at this location? And they will look, and I'll have Scott go into more detail. Scott tries to keep me out of trouble legally, so I don't say anything I'll get in trouble for. They look at it and say, do they agree or do they have any concerns from a federal level? And there are some examples of organizations who will try to block new entities importing product in. So if they agree, then the hard part comes. Then we go to Customs and Border Protection. We got a new port director in the Port of Wilmington, and he didn't stay with us very long. Well, he's kind of still with us. He got promoted. So he came on the job as we were submitting two applications. He came to us from New York, where he was a fraud investigator. So as you can imagine, for all the reasons, he takes his job really seriously. And then he found $1 million, I'm sure you all read in the paper, $1 million worth of cocaine at the port in a shipment of pineapples. And then a few days later, he found another shipment of cocaine hidden in pineapples. So of course, if you're that gentleman, it's Officer Josie, you're thinking, wow, how long has this been happening? Thank goodness I'm here, right? So he's really kind of drilling down on us now, and for good reason. We want him to make sure that bad things aren't happening in our communities. So he's been promoted now. He has oversight over Delaware as well as some other areas. And we've got this whole team that will come in and look at a project and say, is this a good use at this location? So here's what it means for somebody if they're activated and approved as a foreign trade zone here in Delaware. What it means, I'll use two examples. One is a flashlight example. Every component to make a flashlight that you might buy in Walmart or at Walgreens, every one of those, every part has a 5% duty rate on it. So whether you're importing flashlights from China, maybe, or you're importing all the different parts from different places and you're going to assemble them here, the duty due on all those things is 5%. So if you bring it in and you're in an active foreign trade zone, you don't have to pay the duty when it first gets there. So let's say you import 1 million flashlights and they're sitting in your warehouse. Customs knows they're there. You filed your report. They're there. They know they're there. But you don't have to pay the duty. You're deferring that payment. And Walgreens asks you to send 100 of them out. You're going to pay the duty now on the 100 flashlights that leave your warehouse and actually enter the U.S. market, right? They're coming out of that little hidden place and entering the U.S. market. If you ship 500 of them out to some company in Europe, you never pay duty because it never really entered the U.S. market. So you're deferring the duty. If instead of flashlights, you did bicycles, bicycle parts have different duty rates on them. I don't know them off the top of my head, so we'll make up some for fun. So let's say you order the metal chassis, and it comes in and it's got a 15% duty rate on it. And then you order these really cool tires from Germany for the bike, and that's got maybe an 8% duty on it. You put all these parts together, you assemble a bike, and a bike maybe has, let's say, a 5% duty. You're going to pay the lower duty rate when you let those bikes out of your warehouse in, and let them enter the U.S. market. So you're going to be able, in that case, to, they call it inverted duty savings. You not only deferred paying your duty, but now you're going to pay a lower amount. And of course, if in fact you get the bikes in and 10 of them are damaged, you can actually write those off and you never pay duty as long as you can prove to customs that you didn't actually sell the damaged bikes outside and let them enter the U.S. market. So there are a lot of financial advantages to being there. The challenge is that because it's a federal program, they hold the state really accountable to do a couple of things. One of the things is, and Scott always tells me, I have this brainwashed, a little Scott whisper in my ear, never cross the line, Patty. You are never involved in operations. So I never do operations. But I'm supposed to make sure that my active spaces are doing what they're supposed to do, and one of those things is filing their annual report. I get to oversee that and submit it as a final report for the state of Delaware. But the most important thing that I do is market it as an opportunity for companies and areas that are importing and could possibly enjoy the savings, the financial savings of doing it this way from a cash flow perspective. So the state charges for every one of our active zones, they pay us $10,000 a year. I will be sending those invoices out here shortly for the next year. But the federal government says, Patty, it's like a public utility. You can only use that money for things related to the foreign trade zone. So I use it for the marketing purposes. I use it to pay Scott to come here. I use it to pay Scott to try to help us do cost-benefit analysis to make sure if you have a company that wants to apply that it's a good use at a good location and that we think we can get you all the way through the process and that it's going to be worth it to you as a company or as an entity to go through that process. Because whenever the federal government says we're here from the government, we're here to help you, whether it's federal or state, I guess people have that same, I'm not sure about that. But we can pay Scott's services to get you to a certain point. The wonderful news that I am here to share is that we submitted yesterday, so I'm sorry I didn't do it sooner. We submitted yesterday a request to have the Foreign Trade Zone Board approve and post a new fee schedule. So it will still be $10,000 a year for any company or entity that says, I'm going to activate as a foreign trade zone and I'm going to do it for my sole purposes. I'm going to be importing things or I'm going to be exporting things and I'm going to keep my inventory control and I'm going to make sure customs knows what's coming in and what's coming out. Those companies will still pay $10,000 a year. What we have requested and we are confident will be approved is that for an entity such as an airport or a port, such as the Port of Wilmington, that opens a warehouse for multi-users, that will only be $5,000 a year. So hopefully within the next day or so, we'll have that posted. And once it's posted on the federal government, we can then say with some confidence that your fee to us would be $10,000 a year to get you up and running. So I'll stop now, because I'm really excited. You can tell I love this stuff. How weird is that, right? I love this stuff. I'll answer any questions you have. If not, I'm going to turn it over to Scott.
Where's your salary coming from?
Where does my salary come from?
Yes.
Your tax dollars at work, sir. I am a state employee.
You're a state employee?
Yes, sir.
So I just wonder why you're here.
Why am I here?
Yes.
So you love Sussex County.
You want to sell flashlights?
I want to know.
You thought you were from Federalsburg because you're Patty Cannon.
Thank you.
That's where you thought you were.
Yeah. Any questions of council right now?
Does Mr. Burton. Business parks, how do business parks work into this?
So if you choose to move forward and the county applies, and because you own the business park, is my understanding correct? So you could say, I want to designate the entire business park. So we're going to ask the Foreign Trade Zone Board under U.S. Department of Customs to say, here's the map and here's the red line around the area that we want to say, this is a good use at this location. That's all they're saying. Now, the next question is, what are you going to activate? What are we going to ask Customs to activate? Now, when you get to that level, Scott will tell you, Customs is pretty serious. They're going to want to make sure it's secure. You've got cameras. You've got fencing. You've got other things. And you're going to have to manage every piece of material goods that come in and exit that area. So what we think will happen and make most sense for you is to designate the entire place, activate just a warehouse that you would set up to use. What we know is that when I work with businesses, I'm sure Bill sees the same thing, when we try to convince them to set up a warehouse or a business down in Sussex County, their only concern that I hear is that because we don't have the volume of tractor trailers, that sometimes they either have to come down empty or they leave empty. So they double the rate because it costs them something to drive an empty tractor trailer. So if a tractor trailer came down to Sussex County right now and they had a load that was bonded, so Customs is following that material. They know where it came in. They're following it on the map. They know exactly where it is at every given point in time. If I'm that tractor trailer driver and I've got that tractor trailer, right now I have nowhere if Customs says I'm not releasing it yet, I think that's where there's another case of pineapples with another $1 million in cocaine. If they're not ready to release it yet, if that tractor trailer driver doesn't have somewhere he can park it, he's stuck. He's stuck here, and that means money lost for him, revenue lost for him. So if you had a warehouse that was in fact activated, you could transfer that bonded load into that warehouse, let the tractor trailer driver go do whatever else he's going to do, and when Customs is ready to release it, you could then have another bonded tractor trailer driver pick it up and take it to its intended location. So there are some real nice advantages for the county if it were here. But that's, we would only activate and ask Customs to activate where you think you're actually going to use it. Now, if one of your tenants, so let's say Patty Cannon comes down, I rent a warehouse in your industrial park. If one of your tenants wants to start being activated, you've already designated the area, but you want them to activate their warehouse because you don't want to take responsibility for whether Patty Cannon is bringing in cocaine in a pineapple shipment, right? You don't want to own that. So you want to have them activate themselves. They would then have to pay the $10,000 a year. Your $5,000 a year is for that warehouse that we hope you would consider having.
So can the county activate the entire site and then the personal guy that says, hey, I want to be the warehouse guy? So the county would have to pay $5,000 to be in the zone, and then the guy comes in and pays $10,000. Yeah.
Let me just tell you what we've done so far. We've had Patty and we've had Scott to visit the site. And we've looked at the airport, we've looked at the industrial park, and we've looked at the new business park. That's the first thing we did, and we really feel like if we wanted to move forward, we would go for the designation for the entire parcel, for the everything that the county owns. Second thing we did about a month ago, we pulled the existing owners, a few of the existing owners of businesses in the airport that's in the industrial park. We pulled them to an information meeting to explain what we're considering, to see if there would be an advantage for their businesses to be designated a foreign trade zone, the each individual business, if we get everything designated. So I just wanted to let you know what we've done so far. So we had about four businesses show up to that meeting, and there was some interest. I mean, they had to go back and talk to their people, but at the end of the day, we didn't know what direction we're going to go either. So I'm going to turn it over to Scott, and I think Scott can answer some more.
Well, maybe Scott. Okay, but my question would be basically, how will this help Sussex County's industrial park with more economic activity, more jobs, more whatever? Just, I mean, what are the positive things that these, and I'm sure historically you've got some kind of track record, but when something like this happens, because I was reading in one of these little papers about some county like in Tennessee or something, I forget where the state was, and I'm wondering, why did they do it in that location? I mean, why wouldn't we do it if it...
Well, I'll let Scott...
The advantages. Okay.
I'll let Scott talk about
all
that
the rest
a little
of
bit, but
I
think it would be a tool in our toolbox,
not
a tool in our toolbox. We're trying to lease lots in our new Delaware Coastal Business Park, and I think that that's a tool in our toolbox that we can use as a marketing tool. But I'll turn it over to Scott now.
Okay, thank you. Scott Taylor, I'm an attorney with Miller & Company PC. We're a customs and trade law firm. All we do on a daily basis is import compliance, export compliance, and set up foreign trade zones in the United States, all 50 states, and Puerto Rico. The U.S. Foreign Trade Zones program we're talking about is strictly just the U.S. Department of Commerce program. Other countries have free zones and other things you may have heard about or read articles about, completely different programs. We have very stringent rules. One point of clarification, I just want to make on the example that was used a few times with pineapples or whatever. that was in New York City, and that was not in a foreign trade zone. That was at the port. Port of Wilmington, but not a foreign trade zone. So it was the good news about these foreign trade zones is there's a higher level of security. Customs, U.S. Customs knows what goes in and out because you have to admit merchandise on a 214. It's all done electronically, so they have visibility. They know what's in the building at any given time and when it goes out, where it's going. So I want to make that point up front. But the program itself, just a few quick key points. I think Patty covered the benefit pretty well. It's in all 50 states. It's been around since 1934. It wasn't used widely until about the 80s, and that's when our firm was started by Marshall Miller. As companies were beginning to compete internationally, they needed that additional tool in the U.S., especially for U.S. manufacturers that were starting to face imports. And so what this does really is support communities by supporting, and when you have manufacturers, U.S. manufacturing jobs, creating or retaining those jobs. But for the warehousing, I can tell you in the last 6 months, it's been pretty phenomenal to watch all the new warehouses going in because of these new tariffs that the president's implemented across the board. And so it's a tool to defer the customs duty payment on those tariffs for small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and larger businesses. But also, if there's even a small portion of export activity, you can avoid the tariff because the idea of the program is to support local communities like where we're at today, help defray the cost of doing business internationally. So that's the basic framework. What the benefit is, I think, and what I've seen in just touring the site is there are a lot of airports that have the designation from the Department of Commerce, and some have had them for a couple of decades, three decades. I think the mistake that they make is, one, they don't do any marketing. They just get the designation, people forget about it. And two, they don't activate anything. And so what we're proposing is to get start small, activate a building, a warehouse, so that you have something to tell companies both locally that, you know, I think we have a plastic manufacturing company that might import resins. Resins in these big bags have a duty rate generally of about 6%. I just know that, and a lot of them come from Germany for a lot of manufacturers. Those could sit in the warehouse, defer customs duty payment for a long time. It's indefinite. Save that company money until they need it to use it in production. So it would help local businesses immediately that maybe don't want to make that initial commitment or investment on their own to set up a whole foreign trade zone for their manufacturing facility. But what it also does is put you on the map for new activity. There are companies, quite frankly, that we get calls all the time. We have this product. We're looking in this part of the country. We need a warehouse for 6 months, a year. Maybe we have something more happening after that. And so they need an activated warehouse, a building that's already approved by the U.S. Department of Commerce and U.S. Customs. There's not time to go through the process to get that in place. And so the communities that have that are the communities that get that business that may lead to additional business down the line or more other companies coming in. So there are a lot of different ways to look at it, but those I would suggest designating all the publicly owned property like we talked about, but just activating one warehouse initially. And then once your local companies see that this program is being used, it can be done. They become more interested because it's more feasible from their mindset that somebody locally has already gone through the process. It's not as difficult as they may have heard. And so that's kind of where we're what we're proposing. But a couple other statistics. There are over 3,300 companies in the program in the U.S. A lot of these companies have we've set up companies like AstraZeneca in the state before. They have multiple facilities in the U.S. that have been foreign trade zones over time. There are $600 billion of imports coming in, received into all the foreign trade zones collectively. And there are about 330 new companies or applications each year in all 50 states and Puerto Rico. And so it's a program that's being used more than ever because of these new tariffs. And these new tariffs are maybe another reason from the airport standpoint to get this in place, because you can have Another point to just make is that you can have shipment, air shipments coming in with this merchandise, high value, it'd probably be high value electronics or pharma products sometimes, or anything that is smaller in quantity that maybe can be air shipped, that's not too expensive. That can come directly into the airport and be admitted into the foreign trade zone, but it can literally come from any port by sea in the U.S. As long as they know you have an activated foreign trade zone, they can declare it to customs at that port, whether it's L.A. Long Beach, and there's a document procedure basically to ship it in bond across the country, can store it here near one of your local companies, or hold it staging for another community somewhere else in the state, quite frankly. Because right now, other than the Port of Wilmington, I think that as far as general multi-purpose warehouses, there are no activated warehouses. The port has one, and then the next closest, just off the top, I know BWI has, I think, one, and the city of Baltimore has another foreign trade zone. So Delaware, last point I should mention, is in a unique position because you have one of the about 300 foreign trade zone grantee organizations. The state of Delaware represents the whole state, so you know, any company that wants to go through the process goes through the state. But that's unique, as many states have multiple different jurisdictions. You have to deal with the jurisdictional issues. But here, it's the state of Delaware, and we've already done this process you may read about if you look online, called the Alternative Site Framework, which is basically a streamlined application process for the U.S. Department of Commerce that will allow it to be easier for smaller and medium-sized businesses in Delaware to get into this program. Since they've already done the legwork, it's available anywhere within the state because we made the whole state the territory. So that's good news for this particular project. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions, Council?
No.
Any questions?
Who's paying the duty?
So the importer pays the customs duty. It's like a tax, so just for the right to bring it into the country. So the company would save, either defer the payment of the duty, or if they export, avoid it, or manufacture it into a lower duty item.
So what's going to keep them getting out? They don't want to pay it.
U.S. Customs will keep them from it.
Make sure they pay the duty.
U.S. Customs, one of their missions is to protect the revenue of the United States. They've been doing it since George Washington was president. They do it pretty well.
So they're going to collect.
Yeah, they're going to collect. They're going to collect.
They always do, Sam.
Yes.
So who are you going to give it to? Taxpayers?
Dear Lord.
Pardon?
Sam, never mind.
Who gives it to? The federal government?
Yeah, federal government.
Federal government gives it.
That's correct.
Okay, I think we're back, George. What you asked, how do we benefit on this?
Any more questions to the council?
No, Bill will get back to us when we hear more about the program.
Thank you very much. And thanks for coming down and explaining it to us.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Med-Large.